strives for order and regularity in management, operations, and financial results. This desire for order and regularity makes sense because it allows companies to fine-tune their approach to be as efficient as possible and gives shareholders a pleasing sense of stability. When you're blitzscaling, you're explicitly choosing to sacrifice efficiency for speed, which means that the traditional focus on order and regularity needs to be replaced with a unique willingness to embrace a level of chaos that would horrify most Harvard MBAs and their professors. When you start a company, almost everything is an unknown, from the product market fit, to the competitive landscape, to the composition of your future team. There is no way to eliminate all of these uncertainties with careful planning. Most can only be resolved by doing. As a result, you have to take action, even if you know you still have issues to resolve, and sometimes, even if you don't yet know exactly what those issues are. For example, many entrepreneurs start building product before they have a go-to-market strategy. Yet simply throwing up your hands is unlikely to bring success. Passively succumbing to chaos is not a winning strategy. Embracing chaos, on the other hand, means accepting that uncertainty exists and therefore taking steps to manage it. If you know that you'll make mistakes, the answer isn't to sit back and wait for answers to find you, nor is it to charge ahead without preparation or forethought. You can still make smart decisions based on your estimate of the probabilities, even without certainty. And perhaps most important, you can make sure that you have the ability to correct your mistakes. My earlier book, The Startup of You, introduces the useful concept of ABZ planning. Entrepreneurs should always have a plan A, a plan B, and a plan Z. Plan A is your best current plan. Plan B is an alternate plan based on the adjacent possible to which you can pivot if plan A isn't working or you learn of an even better opportunity. Plan Z is your fallback plan for surviving a worst-case scenario. ABZ planning gives you multiple opportunities to recover from mistakes or setbacks. At my first startup, SocialNet, we were delighted when we managed to hire a brilliant server engineer, Plan A. That delight turned to horror when he asked to defer his start date for a year. Needless to say, a startup can't simply put itself on hold for a year. Even if you had the money to wait out the delay, the loss of momentum would probably convince most of the team to quit. We kept looking for other brilliant server engineers, Plan B. But when we couldn't find them, we kept building the service anyway by asking other members of the team to do their best, knowing that we'd have to rebuild the service later. Plan Z. Even if you do manage to hire the people you want, you'll often have to scramble their roles and job titles as the organization changes in response to market feedback. At PayPal, we thought we were a mobile encryption product, and we hired accordingly. Then we shifted rapidly in turn to cash on mobile phones, then cash on Palm Pilots, then payments between Palm Pilots, and finally payments via email. We couldn't have done so if our people were tied to neat and tidy jobs like mobile encryption engineer. Take Jamie Templeton, one of our key early employees at PayPal. We hired Jamie to work on the product, but over the course of just 3 years, he shifted from product to engineering to systems to policy, depending on what the company needed. Jamie is exactly the kind of employee you need in the early days, someone who is willing to embrace the chaos of a startup, which is why I made sure he joined me in the early days of LinkedIn as well. Rule number 2. Hire Ms. Right now, not Ms. Right. For most of Silicon Valley's history, the conventional wisdom on hiring executives into a startup was to quickly bring in an executive who could scale. This meant hiring someone who had experience with much bigger organizations, the idea being that their experience would come in handy at a later stage. In today's startup world, this rule no longer applies. The Darwinian competition is so fierce that your organization needs to be all in on the current stage of scaling. You need managers and executives who are just right for the current phase of growth. After all, you won't have to worry about that next phase if your team can't actually get you there. Hiring someone who has been managing 1,000 people to run a 10-person company is actually counterproductive because the skills needed to succeed during those two phases are very different. The ideal, of course, is to hire executives who can not only excel at your current phase, but stretch to cover the next phase as well. But that scalability should be a secondary concern. The primary concern is current value. You can worry about whether to scale or replace an individual executive when the company approaches its next phase. For example, Entrepreneurs are sometimes advised to avoid hiring salespeople until they are able to secure a VP of sales who has shown that he or she can scale the company to $100 million in sales. This is hogwash. The salespeople you need to ignite hypergrowth are totally different from the salespeople you'll need at scale. When you're trying to sell your product for the first time, you need aggressive, adaptable salespeople who aren't big on following rules. By the time you've achieved scale, you'll need thorough, process-oriented salespeople who can keep a machine running smoothly. You're not going to find one person who is great at both. One thing to look for when evaluating a potential hire is whether the person seems self-aware of which stages of the process he or she excels at and prefers. For example, some people will tend to gravitate toward early-stage companies where they will have more opportunities to take on a broad portfolio of responsibilities. Others might prefer early stages because they enjoy the direct and tangible impact of being a key individual contributor or an important team leader over tackling the very different and more abstract work of being a full-time manager or executive. I've known a number of talented people who prefer joining early-stage companies because while they don't want to take on the challenge of being founders, they do want to be, in the words of Aaron Burr in Hamilton, in the room where it happens. Very few people excel at being an individual contributor, a manager, and an executive, and even those rare employees are likely to have a preferred role. Seasoned Silicon Valley professionals tend to be aware of their preferred stage and role because the disproportionate prevalence of blitzscaling companies gives people a chance to experience more of the different stages. These repeated experiences with different stages let employees zero in on the best fit for their skills and desires. Part of hiring Ms. Right Now also means knowing when to let someone go when the moment passes. For example, a great designer might excel at running a one-woman show at a family or a tribe, but be less effective working as part of a larger design team. At LinkedIn, one of the key employees who fit the description of Ms. Right Now was Mina King. Mina is an incredibly accomplished professional who has carved out a valuable niche at a very specific stage in the life of a startup. You see, Mina specializes in taking a successful software product and helping it go global. She has a very particular set of skills that she has acquired over a long career dating back to the dot-com era. She knows exactly what a software development and product team needs to do in order to make internet software work in different languages and markets, in areas ranging from database schemas to user interface. She then works with a cross-functional team to implement these changes in advance of a global rollout. It's not easy to find people who fit your needs so perfectly. You can't just go on LinkedIn and filter by preferred stage of blitzscaling. Though, come to think of it, that might not be a bad idea. You'll probably have to rely on your network for recommendations, which is where your investors and board of directors can help. But when you find Ms. Right Now, she can add huge value to the organization. This is precisely what Mina did for me at LinkedIn, just as she did for Overture and eBay before joining LinkedIn, which is exactly the same thing she did for two other highly successful software companies, SurveyMonkey and Nextdoor, after she left LinkedIn. In each case, she came to the company at the early village stage because in order for her work to add the most value, the company needed to be big and successful enough to need to globalize, but small enough not to have the internal skills to do so. Rule number 3. Tolerate bad management. When blitzscaling, speed is more important than having a well-run organization. Under normal circumstances, you should strive for organizational coherence and stability. Chaotic, unstable organizations make employees nervous and hurt morale. But when you're scaling up at lightning speed, you may need to reorganize the company 3 times in a single year, or repeatedly churn through members of your management team. When your organization is growing 300% per year, you might have to promote people before they're ready, and then swap them out if they sink rather than swim. You don't have time to be patient and wait for things to work out. You have to act quickly and decisively. There's always a lot of change, and much of it isn't voluntary. You're building teams and the company simultaneously. In the interest of speed, you might even surprise or blindside your people to cut down the time required to make and implement important decisions. Problems relating to job titles are one common symptom of this messiness. In the family and tribe stages, you don't have time for a careful promotion process, and you don't have time to sit around debating whether someone's business card should read Head of Engineering or Senior VP of Product. Nor, for that matter, do you have time to design and order business cards. You might just keep employees' titles the same, even as they fail to reflect organizational progress and level of responsibility. Or you might do things that no rational company would do, such as deliberately inflating job titles to keep people happy and counting on the ability to correct the situation later. Either way, you're taking on organizational risk in exchange for being able to focus efforts wholly on growth. Consider the example of PayPal. While PayPal was a great success, the company was badly managed. And I say that as one of its senior managers. We did a few good things, such as making sure that every employee had a clear primary job and staying focused when working on certain important projects. But for the most part, PayPal's management was a lack of management. There were no one-on-one career development conversations with employees. There was no work done to form teams beyond simply picking who was going to belong to them. The few rules we had were more about individual incentives rather than team management. For example, when people were late to a meeting, the last person to arrive was fined $100 to enforce discipline. Yet, while we knew meetings were important, we didn't designate a note taker to capture key points and action items, a common and basic practice in Silicon Valley. But PayPal's bad management provided a number of counterintuitive strengths while we were blitzscaling. During the critical times when PayPal was developing its business model innovations and scaling up, we found ourselves needing to navigate a series of make-or-break challenges, or, as I like to call them, oh-shit moments. Oh, shit. We have a fraud problem, and we're losing millions of dollars we don't have. Oh, shit. Visa says we have to change the product or they'll shut us down. Oh, shit. eBay, our most important business partner, just started its own venture to directly compete with us. Because of our bad management, we didn't have any preconceived notions of this is what the company must look like in 3 years. The chaotic nature of our management actually kept us nimble in the face of these serious, unexpected landmines. When everyone in the organization has roles that are undefined and in flux, it's easier to say, I know this is what you've been working on for the past 4 days, but now we're doing something different. The internal chaos had the effect of normalizing radical change for our people, which meant they were better able to adjust to the radical changes the outside world was throwing at us. We knew that we were slaloming through a minefield while other people shot at us. To paraphrase Bruce Banner / The Incredible Hulk from the movie The Avengers, the secret behind our superpower was that we were always changing. We were also fortunate in our timing. One thing that holds teams together in the absence of management is an opportunity to win. After the dot-com bust began, a lot of tech companies were failing, but PayPal still had a chance to succeed. All you had to do was look at the chart showing the continuing rise in daily transaction volume. So our people put up with more than they would normally put up with because they wanted to win and liked being part of a team of high-powered, high-IQ players. Classic good management and planning presume a certain amount of stability that isn't always available when you're blitzscaling. One of the misconceptions of entrepreneurship is that you work out a plan and then execute it. Think of the embedded metaphor in building a business. The very language suggests that you're following an architectural plan. But when you're creating and scaling an innovative business model, you often don't have any detailed blueprints. Instead, it's more like, I think a building over there would be a good idea. Let's start digging. Then once the cement is poured and the walls go up, you realize, it should be a hotel, and therefore we need to do this kind of floor plan. Is that bad management? Maybe. But if bad management saves you from building a warehouse in the wrong part of town and lets you quickly turn that structure into a successful hotel, or saves you from losing money on mobile cash and lets you quickly capture the market for global payments, then it might be the best approach you can take. Rule number 4. Launch a product that embarrasses you. It's not that you should strive to produce a bad product. Rather, if you need to choose between getting to market quickly with an imperfect product or getting to market slowly with a perfect product, choose the imperfect product nearly every time. Getting to market fast allows you to start getting the feedback you need to improve it. Any product that you've carefully refined based on your instincts rather than real user reactions and data is likely to miss the mark and will require significant iteration anyway. The ideal is a tight OODA loop. Observe, orient, decide, act, over and over again. Speed really matters, and launching early lets you climb the learning curve to a great product faster. Mark Zuckerberg credits speed for the success of Facebook. In an interview for Reed's Masters of Scale podcast, Mark told us, "Learn and go as quickly as you can. Even if not every single release is perfect, I think you're going to end up doing better over a year or two than you would be if you just waited a year to get feedback on all of your ideas. That focus on learning quickly is the focus of the company." I learned this lesson the hard way when I was running my first startup, SocialNet. I didn't want to be embarrassed by our first release, so the approach we took was to complete the entire product before we pulled back the curtain and let people sign up. This approach delayed SocialNet's launch by a year, and when we finally did launch, we quickly realized that half the features we'd painstakingly implemented weren't important, and half of the important things that our service would be useless without were missing because we hadn't thought of them. While there were other reasons why SocialNet failed, not launching early and iterating based on market feedback was probably the main cause of death. After my experiences at PayPal and the success we found through rapid launches and product iteration, I was determined to launch LinkedIn as soon as possible. Our team defined a list of features we thought were the minimum required to enter the market. Years later, Steve Blank and Eric Ries would dub this a minimum viable product, MVP. For LinkedIn, the MVP included a user's professional profile, the ability to connect to other users, a search function to find other users, and a mechanism for sending messages to friends. Shortly before launch, we started worrying about whether LinkedIn would be useful without a critical mass of profiles. If a user logged into LinkedIn, how could we make it useful even if none of that user's friends had signed up? We decided that what was missing was a contact finder, a version of search that would let a LinkedIn user find potential vendors. For example, if you needed a consultant to help you figure out how to globalize your service, you could use Contact Finder to find Mina King. Our engineering team estimated that it would take us a month to build this feature. We were presented with a difficult choice: delay the launch by a month, or launch without a feature we thought might be essential to our success. Operating on the embarrassment principle, we launched without Contact Finder, and we quickly discovered a far bigger problem. Unlike users of personal social networks like Friendster, which were growing explosively as new users invited their friends to join, LinkedIn users weren't sending any invites. Our user growth was stalled. Our baseline product was embarrassing because no one was using it. If we had delayed the launch a month to build Contact Finder, there still wouldn't have been enough people hanging around to use it, meaning that we would have lost a month building a feature that didn't address the core problem. We estimated that we would need at least 1 million users before search and Contact Finder would be useful, and solving that problem was the top priority. Based on the launch data, we focused on trying to increase virality, which is how we became the first social network to allow you to upload your address book. This feature helped LinkedIn get to a critical mass of over 1 million user profiles, and the rest is history. Keep in mind that you should be embarrassed by your initial release, not ashamed or indicted. The desire for speed is not an excuse to cut dangerous corners. If you trigger lawsuits or burn through your money without learning, it means you did launch too soon. The point of launching your product early is to learn as quickly as possible, but your learning is useless if you don't have the ability to iterate. If your product bursts into flames and kills someone, you probably won't get another chance. The first launch of LinkedIn fell well short of our expectations, but we didn't do any harm. Before you release your product, make sure you know what you're trying to learn and how much risk you can take without endangering your customers or your reputation. Entrepreneurs have to walk a fine line between fixable and fatal flaws. The line between fixable and fatal often depends on the nature of your product. If we consider just two dimensions of product, free or freemium versus paid, and consumer versus enterprise, each combination can be placed along a continuum. A free consumer product can get away with the most flaws because consumers tend to be very tolerant when it comes to something that doesn't cost them anything. A free enterprise product needs to be more refined. Even if it is free, the stakes are higher in a professional setting. A paid enterprise product needs to be even more refined, but it can still have significant flaws because these types of products are intended for expert users who may have no choice but to use the product. A paid consumer product has the least room for error. While consumers are very tolerant of flaws in free products, they will expect products they pay for to be nearly perfect and will grouse loudly about any significant flaws they find. What am I paying for here? Sometimes, you can reduce the risks and uncertainties by obtaining user feedback without actually launching. Design thinking often calls for rapid prototyping and user testing through paper prototypes or visualization tools like InVision and testing tools like usertesting.com. Yet even these techniques adhere to the rule. The goal is to test as early as possible rather than try to get things right before unveiling them to users. Once you've launched your product, you have to make sure you learn the right lessons from market feedback. As the example of LinkedIn's initial launch shows, the key lessons might not be found in what your customers say, but in what they do. The first users of LinkedIn were largely our friends and family, and they didn't tell us, "This crap is useless without more users." Instead, they told us things like, "It seems like it will be pretty useful." Yet even they weren't sending out a ton of invites. Yes, you need to listen carefully to what your users have to say, but you also need to know when to selectively ignore them. When anecdotal user feedback and data contradict each other, listen to the data. People are often quite bad at predicting how they'll react to changes. The scientific term is the inconsistency between predicted and observed behavior. For example, when Facebook was considering adding a feature that would use facial recognition to automatically tag members' faces in photographs, the focus group participants were very negative toward the concept, calling it creepy and an invasion of privacy. Yet when Facebook tested the feature, auto-tagging boosted engagement and users loved it. When I offer this advice, I sometimes hear the objection, "That's not the way Steve Jobs did it." Well, hold on a minute. First of all, contrary to the popular narrative, not all of Steve's products were perfect from the start. The original Mac didn't come with a hard drive. The original iPhone didn't come with an app store. It is true that we can point to a number of entrepreneurs who did launch a great product at the very beginning. For example, when Elon Musk launched the Tesla Model S, it immediately became the highest-rated car on the road, being named Motor Trend Car of the Year in its debut year and achieving a higher Consumer Reports rating than any other car the organization had ever tested. But to do this, you have to believe that you can nail the product-market fit of a new market before you launch and invest substantial amounts of capital based solely on that confidence. Elon bet his own fortune and hundreds of millions of dollars of investor and government money that Tesla could build a better car than any of his century-old competitors. The number of entrepreneurs who are able and willing to bet so aggressively is low. The number who can do so successfully is even lower, and the number who can do it successfully more than once is lower still. So yes, if you are a rare genius and can accurately and consistently predict what the market wants, trusting your instincts will be faster than using trial and error to iterate your way to a better product. Good luck with that approach. As a mere mortal, I prefer market feedback. Rule number 5. Let fires burn. I often tell entrepreneurs that starting a company is like jumping off a cliff and assembling an airplane on the way down. The default outcome for any startup is death, which means that you have to move quickly and decisively to avoid that default outcome at all costs. That doesn't leave a lot of time for dotting each I or crossing each T. At every stage of blitzscaling, there are always far more problems and issues clamoring for your attention than you have the resources to address. You might feel like a firefighter, except instead of trying to extinguish a blaze in one contained spot, you can see separate fires all around you, and you don't have time to put out all of them. One of the ways that blitzscaling entrepreneurs can stay alive is by deciding to let certain fires burn so they can focus on the fires that, if allowed to rage unchecked, really will destroy the company. My Greylock colleague Joseph Antonelli says, "What you say no to is more important than what you say yes to." You can't ignore those fires forever. They are actually dangerous and will eventually require attention. But they aren't relevant at most points during blitzscaling because extinguishing them doesn't move the needle on the expected outcome. Picture an emergency room surgeon trying to save the life of a trauma patient. As she's conducting emergency surgery, she might notice a suspicious-looking mass, but she's going to focus on patching the patient's arteries first. There will be time for biopsies and tests later. After all, if the patient dies on the operating table, even a potential tumor will be irrelevant. The art, of course, is knowing which fires to let burn. Prioritizing your fires tends to be a function of a combination of different factors. The first is urgency. which fire is going to damage or kill your business the soonest. This doesn't have to be limited to fires that endanger the existence of the business. For a startup, a fire that kills your ability to grow is nearly as deadly in the long run as one that threatens to put you out of business tomorrow. Usually, your first step is to decide whether you can simply punt on the problem and tackle it later. When Selena Tobaccowala joined SurveyMonkey, one of the first fires she considered fighting was the design of the product. It was ugly, outdated, and frankly, somewhat embarrassing. But it was also extremely effective and successful. User engagement was good, and customers were happy. Selena decided to defer redesigning the product in favor of more urgent fires. This decision made it harder for her to recruit aesthetically sensitive engineers, but it didn't kill the company. In some cases, if the fires at your startup are burning money but not touching the customer, and if you're able to afford the waste, you might be able to literally buy time and ignore them. Frequently, raising more capital is an easy, though often expensive, way to keep less urgent fires contained. The second factor you want to look at is efficacy. Which fires do you have the ability to extinguish right now, and which will be easier to extinguish later, and vice versa? If a fire is urgent, but you can't effectively fight it right now, you might have to ignore it and hope that external circumstances put it out. Likewise, if it isn't necessarily urgent right now, but will wreak a lot more havoc if allowed to spread, you might consider saving yourself the ordeal later by nipping it in the bud. The final factor to consider is dependency. Will extinguishing fire A make it easier to extinguish fires B and C? These knock-on effects can be very important because there are always more fires burning than you have time to fight at any given time. I believe that there is a Maslowian hierarchy of fires that applies to most rapidly growing startups, where the top of the list is the most important fire to fight first. Distribution. Product. Revenue model. Operations. Competition. What's next? What this means is that for most consumer internet startups, the most important fire is distribution. If your distribution goes up in flames, your company is doomed. If you are able to contain that fire, however, it will make fighting the other fires a whole lot easier. Acquiring users gives you feedback on how to improve your product. Acquiring millions of users or thousands of customers makes it a lot easier to generate revenue. Generating revenue makes it easier to pay for the infrastructure and personnel to scale up your operations, either out of cash flow or by raising investment. And if you have a successful and growing business, then it makes sense to worry about the competition. In the case of LinkedIn, after we had fixed our distribution problem by building in virality and generating a significant user base, we had people harping on the revenue model fire. If I received a nickel for every time someone asked me, "How is LinkedIn going to make money?" during those days, I probably wouldn't have needed another revenue model. But I knew that we should ignore that fire because, one, the lack of revenue wasn't going to be the proximate cause of death unless it prevented us from raising money. And two, the product fire was far more urgent and required our focused attention. If we couldn't find the distribution to acquire a critical mass of at least 1 million users and build a product they found compelling enough to become regular users of the service, or at least respond to LinkedIn requests, the revenue model would be irrelevant. At the time, potential Series A investors wanted to see a business model that showed how LinkedIn would get to profitability. I told potential investors that we weren't going to generate revenue until after the next round of funding, and that therefore it shouldn't matter to them. They insisted anyway, so the team and I generated a financial model that included revenue sources. I don't even remember what we put in it. Rather than waste weeks on it, we simply set aside a single evening, drank a couple of glasses of wine, and put together the model. I might have been a little miffed at having to spend even a single evening, but it was pretty good wine, so it wasn't a total waste. This story also highlights why you need people on your team who have a tolerance for chaos, risk, and uncertainty. Most of us are willing to fight fires. It's a smaller subset of people who are capable of noting the presence of a roaring blaze that might soon cut off all escape routes without allowing it to distract them from their laser-focused effort to fight an even more urgent fire. The members of the LinkedIn team were comfortable with that uncertainty and could still work at full effectiveness even though we didn't have a defined revenue model. Plus, If your people can't let fires burn, they'll spend all their time fighting them, which won't leave any time for coming up with breakthrough opportunities to advance the business. Rule number 6. Do things that don't scale. Throwaway work. Paul Graham, the co-founder of Y Combinator, wrote a famous essay in which he advised entrepreneurs to do things that don't scale. This advice is spot on for young startups, but it's even more important for blitzscaling startups. Engineers hate doing throwaway work. Not only is it wasteful, it offends their sense of efficiency. They are firm believers in the conventional wisdom that says it's better to build your product right the first time, so you only have to build it once. But when you're blitzscaling, inefficiency is the rule, not the exception. To prioritize speed, you might invest less in security, write code that isn't scalable, and wait for things to start breaking before you build QA tools and processes. It's true that all of these decisions will lead to problems later on, but you might not have a later on if you take too long to build the product. A hack that takes a tenth of the time may be more useful than an elegantly engineered solution, even if it has to be thrown away later. Much of the same logic applies to nearly every aspect of your business. You'll often have to do things that don't scale when it comes to sales. E.g., founder Mark Benioff brought in Salesforce.com's first customer, Blue Martini Software, by calling in a favor from its CEO, Monty Zwabin. Operations, e.g., Paul English listed his personal cell number as the original customer service line for Kayak, and so on. Nor is the world neatly divided into things that don't scale and things that scale, with the former smoothly and permanently giving way to the latter. The code or process that scales during one stage of blitzscaling may break down at the very next stage, and whatever you replace it with might not scale at first either. Consider how the founders of Airbnb solved the problem of hosts posting poor quality photos of their rental properties on Airbnb.com. They became the photographers. As Brian Chesky told me, we would borrow cameras from our RISD, Rhode Island School of Design, friends in Brooklyn, then literally knock on the doors of all our hosts. Together, Brian and co-founder Joe Gebbia could photograph about 10 homes per day. Co-founder Nathan Blacharczyk had to stay at the apartment that doubled as their office, making sure the site didn't crash. Talk about doing things that don't scale. Once, a host asked Brian when he'd get paid, and Brian pulled the company checkbook out of his backpack and wrote him a check. "I guess you're not a very big company," the host said as he pocketed the check. As Airbnb took off, the photography function had to scale up considerably, so the founders hired photographers from Craigslist, hit up their RISD friends, and even recruited Airbnb hosts who listed photography as a hobby. By tapping these sources, the company was able to build a stable of 5 to 10 photographers who were paid $50 per home, and whom they tracked using the sophisticated management tool of a spreadsheet with photographers and their assignments. Pretty soon, this system too was overwhelmed, so they hired Ellie Thiele as a summer intern from Syracuse University and made managing photographers her full-time job. By focusing solely on managing the photography, Ellie was able to increase the number of active photographers to about 50. It was only at this point that Airbnb went to a truly scalable solution, software. Nathan wrote some code, adding 2 buttons to the site, one for hosts to request a photographer and the other for Ellie to trigger a payment when a photographer finished an assignment. Eventually, the founders hired Joe Zadeh as an entry-level engineer and asked him to work with Ellie to fully automate the photography process. Airbnb worked its way through 3 different ways of handling photography before building any code and has rewritten the photography system multiple times since then. It wouldn't have made sense for Airbnb to start by building a scalable automated photography system. At the point when the company began this journey, the site was receiving a mere 10 visitors per day, and the only engineering resource was Nathan Blacharczyk. Any work he did on this problem would have delayed all the other engineering work Airbnb needed to get done to grow its business. By doing things that didn't scale, the company was able to grow despite the resource constraints and the wasted work of building spreadsheets that would have to be thrown away later. Rule number 7. Ignore your customers. The fundamental rule of customer service has long been the customer is always right. But for many blitzscaling companies, the key rule is provide whatever customer service you can as long as it doesn't slow you down. And that may mean no service. Many blitzscaling startups will offer email support only, or no support at all, relying on users to find and help one another on discussion forums. On an absolute scale, ignoring your customers is rarely going to be a positive. Customers like to feel heard, and ignoring them will eventually deplete your company's supply of goodwill. But for blitzscaling companies, letting customers feel ignored is often one of the fires that's easier for you to let burn until you have finished fighting the bigger, more deadly fires. Our experiences at PayPal offer a telling example of how hypergrowth requires rapid changes in your approach to customer service. In February 2000, transaction volume was increasing 3 to 5% per day on a compounding basis. Each day, we were falling behind to the tune of thousands of unanswered emails, which compounded the problem because the users who didn't get a response to their initial email would simply write in again. Conventional wisdom would have called for us to devote as many people as possible to customer support, but that's the opposite of what we did. Out of a 40-person team, we had 2 support people, and our office manager was spending half of his time to help out. We had much more urgent fires to fight. For example, during that same time period, we were 1, raising our first major round of venture capital. 2, starting to compete with BillPoint, our biggest partner eBay's attempt to clone our business. And 3, negotiating a merger with Elon Musk's X.com. Suffice to say that things were busy, and we didn't have the bandwidth to solve the customer service problem. So we ignored our customers. After all, none of their complaints stopped transaction volume from growing exponentially. Of course, ignoring our customers had its own cost. Even though PayPal was only listed in the local Palo Alto phone directory, enough people looked up the number and dialed random extensions that at any time of day, every phone would be ringing with an angry customer on the other end. We stopped picking up the phones. Ignoring customers is a temporary solution. Eventually, after we raised a significant round of venture capital and had announced the X.com merger, we had the time and resources to deal with the problem. We forged an alliance with the governor of Nebraska and announced that we were hiring for customer support positions in Omaha. Why Omaha? X.com already had a small customer service team located there. Why had X.com picked Omaha? One of its early employees had a sister living there who offered to help the fledgling startup take customer service calls. We ended up flying out most of the company to hold group interviews so we could hire and train 100 new support employees within 30 days. The PayPal employee we hired to lead the charge, Sarah Imbach, ended up moving to Omaha for 18 months. Fortunately, there was a happy ending to the story for everyone involved. Our product was useful enough that our customers stuck with us until we were able to start serving them. We beat BillPoint, went public, and ended up selling the company to eBay for $1.5 billion. As for Sarah, her 18 months in Omaha were productive on several levels, in addition to building a service and operations organization that still employs over 1,000 people in Omaha. She also met her husband there. Rule number 8. Raise too much money. Entrepreneurs generally try to avoid raising more capital than they need. Raising excessive amounts of capital dilutes their stake in the company and introduces a preference overhang. All that money has to be paid back to investors before the founders and employees get to participate in the upside. Yet when blitzscaling, you should always raise more, preferably much more, than you need. Excess cash allows you to better account for the unforeseeable, and the only thing that's foreseeable about blitzscaling is that you will, at some point, encounter the unforeseeable. That includes anything from a stock market crash or outlandish expenses to an opportunity you couldn't predict in a market that didn't exist when you started out. The fact is, most entrepreneurs are far more likely to raise too little rather than too much money. Nobel Prize-winning economist Daniel Kahneman and his longtime collaborator, the late Amos Tversky, described this general phenomenon when they wrote about the planning fallacy in their 1979 paper, Intuitive Prediction, Biases and Corrective Procedures. The planning fallacy is that you make a plan, which is usually a best-case scenario, then you assume that the outcome will follow your plan, even when you should know better. Almost every entrepreneur I've ever worked with falls prey to the planning fallacy, especially first-time entrepreneurs. Having extra capital gives you a cushion for when outcomes do not, in fact, follow your plan. Moreover, it increases your optionality. If you need to invest in growth, you can do much more without having to go through the time-consuming process of raising another round. As Mariam Nafisi, CEO of Minted, told me, act like you've got half the amount you have in the bank, because you've got to factor in all the failures and all the optimizations that kill great entrepreneurs and businesses all the time. Both of us know so many people who had good ideas and were on the right track, but just ran out of money. At both PayPal and LinkedIn, we raised large financing rounds right before a market meltdown, 2000, 2008, and we sure were glad we did. In the case of PayPal, that money allowed us to keep growing through the dot-com bust. Without it, we wouldn't have made it to our IPO. In the case of LinkedIn, the situation wasn't as dire, but I realized that the value of the optionality from additional funding far outweighed the potential negatives of equity dilution. Even if the money doesn't prove to be necessary, a major financing round can also have positive signaling effects. It helps convince the rest of the world that your company is likely to emerge as the market leader and can discourage investors from backing additional competitors. Most blitzscaling startups have a high burn rate. This is because the drivers of growth, such as sales and marketing, often require significant investments that exceed the cash coming from product sales. It usually takes a lot of money to make a killer company, which is why we have venture capitalists. But while it may make sense to burn cash in order to grow and finance the difference with cash you raise from investors, you should make this investment with long-term profitability in mind. If the unit economics are positive in the long run and capital is available at low cost, then it makes sense to take in investment capital to fuel rapid growth. The company won't be profitable in the short term, but it is building a customer base that will drive long-term value in the form of greater revenues and profits in the far-off future. For technology startups, the amount of money you need to raise will tend to be a function of two primary factors: people costs and the cost of outbound customer acquisition. The good news is that these costs are largely predictable, which gives you a chance to act thoughtfully rather than just react. The classic rule of thumb in Silicon Valley is to raise enough cash for 18 to 24 months of operations. This is because it usually takes about 6 months to raise your next round of venture capital, which means unless you have at least 18 months of runway, you'll have less than a year to make enough progress to convince venture capitalists that you've justified another round of investment. This is important because all financing events are better played as a long game than a short game. We're not the first to observe that investors always prefer to give their money to someone who doesn't need it. Few things trigger a more positive Pavlovian response from a venture capitalist than the words, "We don't need to raise any money." Unfortunately, this is easier said than done. When you are blitzscaling your startup, growth is so rapid and your organization is pushing its limits in so many ways that multiple things are always breaking. It's tempting to fix these things with money, but you have to resist that temptation. Only spend money to fix things that are on the critical path to reach the next phase of scale. Everything else can wait. As I described earlier, at PayPal, we deliberately avoided spending money on customer service because we knew it wasn't the critical path. The more you can keep juggling and defer spending, the more likely you'll be able to raise money without the pressure of a short runway. Remember, starting a company is like jumping off a cliff and assembling an airplane on the way down. If you run out of money for the fuel and parts you need to get airborne, no one will ever get to find out how efficiently you spent it along the way. Rule number 9, evolve your culture. Nearly all founders, business gurus, and academics agree that organizational culture is important. While there are a lot of inefficiencies you can tolerate and fires you can let burn during your blitzscaling journey, ignoring your culture is not an option. Brian Chesky of Airbnb defines culture in a simple and concise way: a shared way of doing things. Clearly defining the way an organization does things matters because blitzscaling requires aggressive, focused action, and unclear, hazy cultures get in the way of actually implementing strategy. Netflix co-founder and CEO Reed Hastings told me, "Weak cultures are diffuse. People act differently and don't understand each other, and it becomes political." Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg have done many wonderful things at Facebook, and one of them is building a unified culture that is devoted to aggressive experimentation and data-driven decision-making, as summarized by Mark's original motto, "Move fast and break things." Facebook's culture helps employees understand that they shouldn't be afraid to try things that might fail. This allows Facebook to move faster and to move on from failed experiments quickly. Imagine if someone asked a random employee from your startup the following questions. What is your organization trying to do? How are you trying to achieve those goals? What acceptable risks are you incurring to achieve those goals more quickly? When you have to trade off certain values, which ones take priority? What kind of behavior do you hire, promote, or fire for? Would she be able to answer those questions? If you asked another employee, would he give the same answers? When organizations have strong cultures, their employees give consistent answers and act accordingly. A strong commitment to a culture will sometimes mean passing on hiring A players who don't fit that culture. At PayPal, for example, Max Levchin instituted a problem-solving test as part of the hiring process for joining our engineering group. He wanted a culture that was focused on solving big-picture problems, not simply writing good code. If a person was a great programmer but didn't have a problem-solving orientation, we didn't hire him or her. At LinkedIn, we tried to recruit people who were hardworking but also family-oriented. Our founding team members had families, and we wanted to establish the norm that employees could go home to have dinner with their families and then work remotely later in the evening. Candidates who believed that a startup needed everyone at the office until 10 o'clock every night would inevitably frustrate colleagues and themselves, so they were screened out. Conversely, candidates who wanted to work a 9-to-5 job would also be screened out, no matter how talented. Culture is critical because it influences how people act in the absence of specific directives and rules, or when those rules reach their breaking point. In a notorious example from 2017, acting at the request of United Airlines, Chicago Department of Aviation employees forcibly dragged passenger David Dow off an overbooked flight, breaking his nose, knocking out two of his teeth, and giving him a significant concussion in the process. The next morning, United CEO Oscar Munoz sent a rather perplexing email to United Airlines employees. Our employees followed established procedures for dealing with situations like this. While I deeply regret this situation arose, I also emphatically stand behind all of you, and I want to commend you for continuing to go above and beyond to ensure we fly right. I do, however, believe there are lessons we can learn from this experience, and we are taking a close look at the circumstances surrounding this incident. Treating our customers and each other with respect and dignity is at the core of who we are, and we must always remember this no matter how challenging the situation. The David Dow incident is a classic example of how a poor articulation of company values can weaken the culture. The employees on the ground believed they needed to bump passengers from the flight so that United could get another flight crew to their plane, i.e., flying right, and that meeting metrics such as on-time departures and flight cancellations was more important than treating customers with respect and dignity, which most of us would agree does not include breaking their noses and knocking out their teeth. In contrast, Southwest Airlines is not only clear about its company values, but makes them the emphasis of hiring and management. The mentality isn't, "We'll know it when we see it." Instead, it is, "Does this person already live the way we do?" The company uses behavioral interview questions to determine whether candidates are a cultural fit. For example, to determine someone's ability to be a selfless team player, they might ask her to describe a time when she went above and beyond to help a coworker succeed. The airline acknowledges that certain positions call for specific skill sets. As Southwest puts it, "We're not going to hire a pilot who has a great attitude but can't fly a plane." But when it comes down to two equally qualified candidates, the one who lives Southwest's values receives the offer. And even when Southwest finds a qualified candidate who doesn't have the right values, it will keep looking until it finds someone who does, no matter how long the job has gone unfilled. Southwest's development and promotion practices are also explicitly tied to company values. In performance reviews, employees are assessed not just on results, but also on how they got those results. In fact, people are actually rated on things like their warrior spirit, servant's heart, and fun-loving attitude. In other words, Culture isn't just manifested as a mission statement on Southwest's website. It's woven into the airline's processes and practices. In both cases, culture has real business implications. In the case of United Airlines, a culture without strong values led to a disastrous public relations fiasco. For Southwest Airlines, the value of employees' servant's heart and fun-loving attitude shows up in the concrete metrics of customer satisfaction. Even though Southwest's performance on metrics such as on-time arrival is decent to above average, the airline consistently has the fewest customer complaints per passenger carried. Organizational culture has played a key role in the rise of Silicon Valley. Most of the iconic companies that have shaped and defined the technology industry, Hewlett-Packard, Intel, Apple, Google, Facebook, are known for their distinctive cultures regardless of their era. The same can be said for more recent startup market leaders like Airbnb and Salesforce.com. Typically, the credit for these cultures goes to the founders. Bill Hewlett and David Packard are synonymous with the HP way. Bob Noyce, Gordon Moore, and Andy Grove are referred to as the Intel Trinity. Steve Jobs, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, and Mark Zuckerberg are seen as the sources of Apple's, Google's, and Facebook's cultures. Yet while the personalities of the founding team play a critical role in defining an organization's culture, it is more accurate to say that an organization's culture emerges over time based on the actions of many people, not just the founders. The primary culture of an organization typically originates in the functional area that is most critical to the success of the company. Early on, engineering predominated, and engineering culture formed the basis of things like the HP way. As the technology industry matured, sales assumed a greater importance, and sales-oriented cultures arose at companies like Oracle and Cisco. Companies today might also have a product culture, design culture, marketing culture, finance culture, or even an operations culture. Any and all of these cultures can be successful, but you should focus on whichever function is key for your organization to succeed. In addition to the role this choice plays in the company's values, the executive in charge of the functional area that drives the culture also tends to be the most likely successor to the CEO. The development of organizational culture is intimately intertwined with branding. Culture is central to the story that we tell ourselves and others about who we are and our place in the world, as well as the stories others tell about us. You can list all the values you want on your website, but the only way they become an integral part of your culture is if you make them a part of your strategy and make sure that you and others can tell stories backed with hard evidence and concrete details about living up to them. So how do you develop a strong culture at your organization? I believe the best approach represents a middle ground between hoping that the culture evolves organically through benign neglect and trying to define a comprehensive culture up front. The former approach risks developing a weak culture or one that doesn't fit the company's needs. The latter may be too rigid and inflexible. Most cultures begin to form organically. As we've discussed previously, the founders of the organization have a major influence on the culture simply because of who they are. If a founder believes that certain beliefs and practices are fundamental keys to winning, those beliefs and practices tend to be transmitted to the people who work closely with him or her. This might occur via filtering during the hiring process, as a result of working closely together, or both. For example, Larry Page of Google is a technologist with a strong academic background. As a result, Google developed a technology-oriented academic culture that strongly resembled Stanford's graduate computer science department. For example, Google engineers sat in four-person offices because that is how Stanford organized graduate students' offices. Google hired Eric Schmidt to bring in stronger business experience, knowing that Eric's own academic background, he earned a PhD in electrical engineering and computer science, EECS, at UC Berkeley, would allow him to effectively synchronize culturally with Larry and co-founder Sergey Brin. In blitzscaling companies, culture becomes increasingly important and increasingly difficult to maintain as the organization grows. In the beginning, the bond that employees form in the early days of the company can be a powerful force in shaping the culture, but this gets more challenging as more people come on board and spontaneous interactions give way to more formalized structures. Transmitting culture organically requires both personal interaction and time. This osmosis works during the family and even tribe stages of blitzscaling, but breaks down at later stages. If the founders don't have personal interactions with all employees, or if those interactions are brief and sporadic, osmosis doesn't work. And when a company is doubling or tripling in size every year, even brief and sporadic personal interactions with the founders are a best-case scenario. By the time an organization reaches the village stage of blitzscaling, at least 100 employees, the mesh of person-to-person interaction is insufficient, especially when culture needs to be synchronized across multiple offices. Drew Houston makes sure that all Dropbox employees are aware they may need to help recreate the culture. We tell people, you might have just joined last week, but sooner or later, you'll be an old-school Dropboxer too. So remember the things you like about this place now, because it'll be your responsibility to make sure those things stick around. It's not always easy to move from organic to deliberate cultural transmission. Reed Hastings' experience is typical. When we, Netflix, went public, we had 150 people, Reed told me. People were worried that now that we were public, everything would go to shit. We'd put in a lot of process and stop taking risks. What we've done is to promote employee freedom. If you want to operate with very few rules, you need to set context. Yet while early employees often fear that deliberate cultural development will bring bureaucracy, as Reed argues, culture is actually a substitute for bureaucracy and rules. The stronger you make your culture, the less you'll have to bind people's behavior with rigid directives. The two key levers of deliberate cultural transmission are communications and people management. Communications are important because they provide founders with a direct channel to all employees. This can take many forms, ranging from formal in-person meetings, to electronic communications, to things as seemingly neutral as office layout and design. Airbnb, for example, employs a wide range of channels to maximize cultural transmission. The weekly email co-founder Brian Chesky sends to all Airbnb employees is a powerful one. You have to continue to repeat things, Brian told our class at Stanford. Culture is about repeating, over and over again, the things that really matter for your company. Airbnb reinforces these verbal messages with visual impact as well. Brian hired an artist from Pixar to create a storyboard of the entire experience of an Airbnb guest from start to finish, emphasizing the customer-centered design thinking that is a hallmark of its culture. Even Airbnb conference rooms tell a story. Each one is a replica of a room that's available for rent on the service. Every time Airbnb team members hold a meeting in one of those rooms, they are reminded of how guests feel when they stay there. At Amazon, Jeff Bezos famously bans PowerPoint decks and insists on written memos, which are read in silence at the beginning of each meeting. This memo policy is one of the ways that Amazon encourages a culture of truth-telling. Memos have to be specific and comprehensive, and those who read the memos have to respond in kind, rather than simply sit through some broad bullet points on a PowerPoint deck and nod vague agreement. Bezos believes that memos encourage smarter questions and deeper thinking. Plus, because they are self-contained, rather than requiring a person to present a deck, they are more easily distributed and consumed by a wider population within Amazon. The late Steve Jobs used architecture as a core part of his deliberate communication strategy at Pixar. He designed Pixar headquarters so that the front doors, main stairs, main theater, and screening rooms all led to the atrium, which contained the cafe and mailboxes, ensuring that employees from all departments and specialties would see people from other groups on a regular basis, thus reinforcing Pixar's collaborative, inclusive culture. In Walter Isaacson's biography of Steve Jobs, John Lasseter, Pixar's chief creative officer, says, "Steve's theory worked from day one. I kept running into people I hadn't seen for months. I've never seen a building that promoted collaboration and creativity as well as this one." Build a ship of Theseus. The other main lever for cultural development is the organization's people management practices. After all, the strongest influences on organizational culture are often who you hire, promote, and fire. When he visited our blitzscaling class at Stanford, Eric Schmidt shared how Google's hiring strategy shaped its culture. "The people that you hire make your culture," Eric said. "We'd hire people who were special in some way. You don't hire generic people. You hire people who have had stress and achievement." Culture is a key part of the hiring process at Airbnb, too. Each candidate also goes through a values interview conducted by an Airbnb employee who isn't that candidate's hiring manager. This ensures that values are considered independently of how much the organization needs that candidate's particular job skills. When the business is growing that quickly, it's usually desperate for bodies and can be tempting to simply pay whatever is necessary to get employees through the door. The problem is that you end up hiring mercenaries rather than missionaries. And if you're tripling the company's size each year, you can shift your company from a